Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, looking back at 30 years of AIDS and how the epidemic changed the nation.
We did not, disintegrate. We didn't fall apart. We didn't, get into a debate of, are these people really my community? Are they really my family? Everyone said, of course it's my family. Of course it's my community. And here's what we're going to do.
Also, author Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City is put to music, a San Francisco story of love, liberation, and loss of innocence in the 1970s. Plus, making math fun, how a Silicon Valley hedge fund manager created a teaching method that's gone viral on the internet.
2 is x, 2 is also y. So parentheses first, 2 minus 1 equals 1. Yay!
It's the California Report. Years ago this weekend, the top-rated TV show was Dallas. Raiders of the Lost Ark was about to hit the theaters, and Ronald Reagan was halfway through his first year as president. It was also the start of a medical mystery, a mystery solved by the discovery years later of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But it began on June 5, 1981, with a report from the federal government that 5 previously healthy young men in Los Angeles had come down with a rare lung disease. Within weeks, there were other news reports, like this one on NPR's Morning Edition in early July, raising still more questions.
Today, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta releases its weekly report. Findings show that a form of cancer has suddenly surfaced in unusual amounts in gay men. Laurie Garrett reports from San Francisco.
Kaposi's sarcoma is a rare...
In the months that followed, gay men in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco followed the news with growing alarm, alarm verging on panic. Paul Bomberg was a community activist in San Francisco at the time.
It's true, for a while we didn't know it was an infectious agent, we didn't know what the agent was, but people certainly understood that their friends who lived lives just like them, who were their age and lived with them in the Castro or wherever they lived, were getting sick and dying very, very quickly.
Before long, San Francisco's Castro district was transformed from a neighborhood celebrating the growing gay rights movement and sexual freedom to the epicenter of an exploding epidemic.
First, you did get the fear, and then, of course, as soon as people knew people who were sick, we were trying to take care of them. So there was an issue of, making sure they ate, making sure they got medical care, making sure that people didn't have insurance got care, and all of that went on for a while.
Family members, neighbors, boyfriends, and co-workers became caregivers. But Paul Bomberg recalls that those acts of selfless generosity were matched by ignorance, fear, and calls for discrimination.
Fire them from their jobs, lock them up in camps. Horrible, horrible things were proposed.
The toll mounted. First hundreds, then thousands of people, most of them gay men, were dead or dying. At a Starbucks in the Castro this week, 2 friends recalled those early years. Manuel Barrero learned he was infected with HIV in 1989, and he wasn't alone.
I've had many friends that are already gone. The whole gang's gone. There's probably 4 of us left. So it's been a great loss of friends and family, and opportunities have been lost.
How did you deal with that when it was happening?
Well, first in denial, definitely denial. And then it's time to face the denial and the reality. And the reality was grim back then.
His friend Charles Hummel remembers delivering meals in Los Angeles to people with AIDS, people who couldn't leave their homes.
That was frightening, and I used to try to make friends with them, because that's the only thing you can do. I mean, they're living their life, they're dying in that little apartment, And that was a sad part.
There were many, many sad parts in those early years before new medications brought rays of hope.
I'm doing good. Do you have any pain today?
From the start, San Francisco General Hospital was ground zero. For some of the first patients appeared with mysterious and very troubling symptoms. Brave nurses and doctors, unsure if they themselves were at risk, tended to the sick and dying. Ward 86 at San Francisco General pioneered what became known throughout the world as the San Francisco model for comprehensive AIDS care.
I just try to imagine how things were back then and all the young people that came through this ward and couldn't make it.
Social worker Hernan Ludueño Segre at Ward 86 this week. He says while so many did not make it, the dead are not forgotten.
I think of this as a living museum, but also there's something very spiritual about this place. I feel sometimes that we're surrounded by a lot of people that were here at some point and are here no longer.
Dr. Diane Havler was a resident at San Francisco General in the 1980s. Today, she's chief of the AIDS division here.
I would say AIDS was characterized by death, by despair, by fear, and by futility.
And she says there was massive collateral damage to families, businesses, a whole generation of men who saw California as a place to start a new life, only to see their lives end too soon.
We saw people coming in extremely ill. We saw people coming in with exotic cancers. We saw people coming on with purple skin lesions, which is a hallmark of Kaposi's sarcoma. People came in blind because one of the infectious in AIDS caused blindness. People came in with seizures. And people came in demented because untreated HIV disease.
About all they could offer them was compassion. The despair peaked in the early 1990s when futility and fear morphed into anger and activism. Groups like ACT UP used no-holds-barred tactics to shame government, religious institutions, and drug companies to do more. Their protests paid off. California politicians like Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, and Henry Waxman fought for more federal funding. By the mid-90s, new medications had been fast-tracked. They called it the AIDS cocktail, drugs that fought the virus and transformed a death sentence into something more manageable. Today, many people with AIDS can treat their disease with a single pill once a day, something Dr. Havler says that would have been hard to imagine 15 years ago.
Because when we started out with HIV cocktails, 15, 20, you may remember this, 25 medications per day that patients would have to take.
And multiple times a day sometimes.
Multiple times a day with really difficult side effects.
AIDS is a very different illness than it was 30 years ago. What began as a disease of mostly gay white men now claims many Latinos, African Americans, women, and their male partners. It's rarely on the front pages anymore, but it's still a huge problem, especially in places like Africa, where millions of people are living with it. Despite all the progress, even in San Francisco, there's still almost two new HIV infections a day.
How many tubes you got to take?
Only one.
Wow.
Your date of birth, please?
This week at Ward 86, a patient we'll call Andy says he was infected with HIV a year ago. He says he was taking his HIV meds until his Medi-Cal ran out, along with his pills. When he started back up, he says the meds made him sick, so he stopped.
It seems to have taken a lot of my energy. It's made me very fatigued a lot. I feel very sleepy and tired quite often. I don't feel like I can do the same things that I used to do.
Today, AIDS is a chronic condition, more like diabetes than terminal cancer. In the past three decades, new laws have been passed at the local, state, and national level to make discrimination against people with AIDS illegal. And yet, there's still a stigma. Social worker Hernan Ludueña Segre recalls what happened to one patient who learned not long ago that he was HIV positive.
And he went back to his place that day, and all of his roommates had left the apartment and left him alone with the full rent, and he never saw them again. It's hard to believe that those things are still happening, but they are happening.
The death rate from AIDS is far lower today than it was. More than 100,000 Californians are living with HIV, and with treatment, they can expect to live a long time. In fact, says Dr. Havler, HIV and geriatric medicine are intersecting.
To think that we'd be talking about HIV aging back in the 80s was just completely and utterly incomprehensible. But you know what? That is the story of AIDS.
The first three decades of HIV/AIDS claimed the lives of more than a million Americans. Behind the numbers, plays and music that never got written, parents who never saw their children grow up, kids who never graduated from high school. Through all the loss that could not have been imagined in 1981, the epidemic also changed us. It changed politics and gay rights, the way life-saving drugs are approved by the federal government. Today, Paul Boneberg is executive director of the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, curator of a history he says he's proud of.
The community was transformed and is certainly stronger and more vibrant than it was 30 years ago. I think part of it is because of AIDS, but most of it is because of our response to AIDS.
Sunday morning, thousands of bicyclists will begin a 7-day ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles to raise money for HIV/AIDS. And in Los Angeles, there will be a candlelight march through West Hollywood marking the 30th anniversary. To see historical photos from the early years of the epidemic, go to californiareport.org. Before the AIDS epidemic, there was lots of sex, drugs, big hair, and disco in San Francisco, and now it's back, at least on stage. Tales of the City, a new musical that's just opened at San Francisco's American Conservatory Theater. It's based on Armistead Maupin's much-loved novel from 1977 and the first of its many sequels. It's a story of sexual liberation, gay and straight, and the clash of values between bohemian and old-money San Francisco. And as KQED's Cy Musiger reports, the show's creators share a deep emotional attachment to the story.
Jake Shears and John Garden lead the band The Scissor Sisters, a glam rock group that celebrates a very out pansexuality. They got a call 5 years ago asking them to write the lyrics and music for Tales, and Shears says they jumped at the chance.
Well, that's new.
Oh, come on. You don't have guys falling all over you?
I'm usually the one who does the falling.
I just figured the best way to take on the project was to start writing songs.
I've seen true love and heard those wedding bells. They always seem so out of reach, happening to someone else. Thank God they're close, don't make the man. Because I'm naked, but I'm ready for more than just a one-night stand. But
I think the songs that have survived from those early kind of writing days are the ones that are just very clear moments that stand alone.
A certain aspect of this, easy in a way, is that the characters are really solid, and once you read them for the first time, you never forget them.
The book meant a lot to Shears. He was 13 when an older gay couple gave him a copy.
And I think they probably figured out I was gay before I did, so I read it eagerly and I loved it. It was very significant for me because it was probably the first thing I ever read with kind of a positive viewpoint from a gay perspective.
Like many other gay men, Shears says the book was a rite of passage.
And it was also really important with my relationship with my mother. A few years later, I gave the books to her, and she loved them.
Being true to yourself and honest about it with others was a central theme for Armistead Maupin when he serialized Tales of the City in the San Francisco Chronicle 35 years ago.
Well, I don't think people are living any differently. There's the issues that are at stake in Tales of the City are the same. It's basically about longing and love and loss.
The story begins with the character of Mary Ann Singleton, a young, straight woman from Cleveland visiting San Francisco for a holiday. To her mother's dismay, she decides to stay.
I'll write a new chapter, tell Cleveland goodbye.
Singleton finds an apartment and fellow tenants who become her new family, with the landlady, the pot-growing Anna Madrigal, as a mysterious mom. Maupin has just published the 8th Tales novel, with Madrigal still a lead character.
Mrs. Madrigal, the landlady at 28 Barbary Lane, who's still around in real time, by the way, and I'm still writing about her, refers to the logical family versus the biological family. Sometimes the two cross. And sometimes they don't. You have to make your own. And that's kind of what Tales is all about. For me, it translated into that as a gay man. I had to accept myself and love myself and get on with it.
The characters' relationships with their moms are a major theme of the show. Maupin even gave his own coming out letter to the character of Michael Tolliver.
But I was essentially writing to my parents, who were subscribing to the Chronicle at the time. And it was my slightly cowardly way of telling them who I was.
Dear Mama, I wouldn't have written if you hadn't have told me that you were working for Anita Bryant on the Save Our Children campaign. That more than anything made it clear to me I had to tell you the truth that I'm gay and I don't need saving from anyone.
Like the books, the show manages to balance wit, melodrama, and sentiment. Credit for that has to go to playwright Jake Witte, who won a Tony for Avenue Q. 5 years ago, he watched the PBS miniseries based on the First Hills book and decided to make it his next project. Witte was, like Jake Shears, a longtime Tales devotee.
My sister had given them to me, and she thought I would love them, which I did.
It was 1993, and Witte had just moved to New York City.
There were people that I wanted to be my friends, and I wish I could have known then that I would be writing a musical for those characters, because I think it would have made the next 10 years a lot easier, knowing I had this coming down the road.
As a gay man, Witte says, he wishes he could live in the idyllic San Francisco Maupin portrayed, before AIDS tore through the community. But Maupin doesn't indulge in nostalgia. He says it wasn't really a golden age.
People who look back on the past and long for it, who get sentimental, tend not to be African-American, tend not to be women, tend not to be gay people. Our history as Americans is improving things socially. I like that about us. That's what I'm proudest of most about America.
Maupin is nursing one fantasy, seeing the show mounted in the West End in London or on Broadway. After all, librettist Jeff Witte is working again with Avenue Q director Jason Moore, and most of the cast and crew have worked on and off Broadway. But for now, Tales of the City continues only at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco through July 24th. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker. But
you're selling on the corner, Marianne. You can tell them all that you're Marianne. From San Francisco, San Francisco.
Well, you don't need to be an award-winning playwright to put down your thoughts about things you hear on the California Report. Send your email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. While you're there, you'll see all the stories we archive. And if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us on iTunes. Anthony Wilson is hardly the first musician to fall in love with the seductive sounds of Brazil. But in his review of Wilson's new album, Campobello, the California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert says the Los Angeles guitarist's passion has taken him a long way from California.
Like any working jazz musician, Anthony Wilson was well acquainted with Brazilian music through the numerous bossa nova tunes that filtered into the standard jazz repertoire after the late 1950s. But the guitarist became smitten with Brazil's vast and varied array of rhythms during a 2005 South American tour with Diana Krall, who's been his main employer for the past decade. A few years ago, Wilson recorded a gorgeous duo album with Chico Pinheiro, a brilliant young guitarist and composer he bonded with on that tour. His new album, Campobello, takes his rapidly maturing relationship with Brazil several steps further. Rather than composing a sheaf of tunes directly inspired by Brazilian styles, he developed pieces ripe for interpretation by a superlative cast of Brazilian musicians, like this laid-back, countrified shuffle Illyria, featuring delicate brushwork by drummer Edu Ribeiro. Thank you. in the Sao Paulo neighborhood that gives the album its name, Campo Belo features some of the best young players in Brazil, including bassist Guto Virci and pianist Andre Mamari. As if making the point that these guys can swing when they want to, Wilson includes After the Flood, a piece with a melodic line that just keeps tumbling forward. Son of legendary bandleader, arranger, and composer Gerald Wilson, who's still going strong at 92, Anthony started making a name for himself as a composer and arranger in the late 1990s with a series of acclaimed albums featuring a nine-piece ensemble. More recently, he's been displaying his impeccable guitar skills, like on his 2009 organ trio session, Jack of Hearts. While his translucent tone sometimes brings Pat Metheny to mind, Anthony doesn't go for grandiose anthems. On Campo Belo, even his most intricate pieces feel like lovingly rendered miniatures, with warm, glowing harmonies like this brief watercolor-washed Patrimonio. In addition to touring and recording with Diana Krall, Wilson has taken on a series of high-profile gigs with the likes of Barbra Streisand, Michael Bublé, and Chris Botti. Campo Belo is his eighth release in about 15 years, just enough to maintain a tantalizing presence as one of jazz's most imaginative guitarists. It's hardly surprising that Wilson was drawn to Brazil, but there's nothing predictable about the music on Campo Belo, an album full of pregnant silences and subtle surprises.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Campo Belo by Anthony Wilson. Well, the biggest buzz in education circles these days is coming not from an educator, but a one-time hedge fund manager in Silicon Valley. The former Ivy League whiz kid has revolutionized math instruction with a series of online lessons that have gone viral on YouTube. Now, as Elaine Corey reports, his Khan Academy is rocking California classrooms.
It all started a few years ago when Sal Khan watched his young cousin Nadia struggling with her math homework. He saw firsthand what he says is wrong with math instruction in America, a rigid model that forces all students to learn at the same pace.
Obviously, the best way to tutor them is not to tell Nadia, I'm going to teach you exponents for 10 minutes. Even if you only understand exponents halfway, I'm going to move on to negative exponents in the next 10 minutes.
Khan turned that model on its head, letting Nadia set her own pace for learning. He began posting little 10-minute math lessons online, and the rest is history. Today, with 2,100 free tutorials, the nonprofit Khan Academy has the most popular education website in the world. And a pilot program begun last fall in Los Altos Public Schools is proof that self-paced math instruction can also work in the classroom.
Good morning, fifth grade. Great to see you this morning. I would remind you that today we're working on those fifth grade goals in our classroom on Khan Academy, so let's get busy.
These 30 students in Cami Thorderson's class are clustered in small groups around laptops. Key to this experiment, the kids work together, helping each other to solve math problems posted on the Khan Academy website.
So 2 is X and 2 is also Y, so parentheses first. 2 minus 1 equals 1. Yay!
Andrew and Ryan have already mastered the fifth grade curriculum, so they've moved on to algebra. After finishing some of Khan's online modules, they test their understanding in a series of exercises.
So you're at 1 minus
3 is negative 2.
Negative 2 times 6.
No, remember,
Remember, order of operations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Each correct answer earns them energy points. Students compete against each other for the most points, which they can redeem for cool badges.
So, like, moon badges aren't too hard, because I have a lot. I have 227. But then here, it gets hard about here at the Earth badges.
While the students are busy, teacher Thorderson wanders among them with an electronic tablet in hand. It displays a customized Khan Academy graph showing in real time what each child is working on. Thorderson can zoom in on any student for a color-coded display of their work.
The blues are the problems he got correct. The reds are the problems he missed. And I can actually then go to him and say, let's look at this problem that you missed. Let's work through this a little bit.
After 6 months with the Khan Academy program, Thorderson is spending less time grading tests or preparing lectures and more time actually teaching one-on-one. She's sold on the program.
It's just brought our math class to a whole nother level. And you can hear the excitement in the collaboration that happens in this classroom. They're talking to each other about math. They're just excited.
Some fifth graders have surged ahead, and Khan Academy has helped slower kids catch up. The pilot program in seventh grade targeted Los Altos students who had fallen several grade levels behind. Nearly all of them have made good progress. Parents also seem to support the Khan Academy, and the students say they prefer it to their old math class.
It's not as boring as writing in a textbook.
Yeah, there's different modules, so you could do whatever you want.
And if we were doing math in the textbook right now, we wouldn't be doing trigonometry.
The Los Altos district is working with Khan to include up to 1,000 students in the program next fall. Meanwhile, he's been scooping up accolades, awards, and millions of dollars in funding from the Gates Foundation and Silicon Valley backers. Khan's been criticized as a dilettante and dismissed as just another quick fix for education. But he doesn't care.
The students, the teachers, everyone is way more engaged. And there's reason to believe that many of the students are learning well ahead of the grade level. And I'm not talking about 10% ahead. I'm talking about 3-4 grade levels ahead.
By September, Khan hopes to have pilot programs in a dozen school districts, mostly in California. For the California Report, I'm Elaine Corey.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Jefferson Beavers, Julia Bernstein, and Nicholas Carpenter. The acting senior producer is Victoria Malione. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend, everybody. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.